the decline of home cooking and the rise of convenience food is a trend that concerns our guest this hour. And she set out to find out why so many people are not making homemade meals in their own kitchens. What is holding people back from cooking? Is it time? Is it knowledge? Is it a lack of desire? All of the above? Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up on 9 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Monday, October the 10th. We will talk with the author of The Kitchen Counter Cooking School about how she changed the lives of 9 kitchen novices with a few simple lessons. And I'm guessing you might have some questions or some lessons of your own that you would like to share at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us on Twitter at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Kathleen Flynn, author of The Kitchen Counter Cooking School. She is also the author of The Sharper Your Knife, The Less You Cry. And she joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning.
And you are going to be in Wisconsin on November the 9th at 7 p.m. at the Next Chapter Bookstore in the Milwaukee area. So we look forward to your visit to Wisconsin for that.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. We're looking forward to coming back. My husband's very excited. He loves the beer there.
Oh, good for him. Well, listen, when you come back, will you come over to my house and give me a kitchen counter cooking school lesson?
We may be able to arrange that, actually.
tell us how this came about. You apparently noticed a woman shopping at a local grocery store, and her cart was just filled with processed foods, and you wondered, you were kind of sad to see that.
Yeah, it's funny. I actually had just come back from Paris, where I had graduated. I was, as I talk about my first book, I went to the Le Cordon Bleu there in Paris, and they had invited me back to do a graduation speech. And in the preparation of doing that speech, I thought, God, I've only been out of school for 2 years, and I'm not really kind of doing anything with my degree, and what am I going to do? And I gave this speech, and it was kind of this really existential moment. And then I came back from that trip, and I was wandering around the store that's actually the closest to my house, and I saw this cart. And I actually initially thought it might be one of those carts they take around the store to restock the shelves because mm-hmm. it was, you know, partly full. And had things like, you know, those kits to help hamburger and, you know, dried pasta mixes and jars of gravy. And as I looked at it, I realized there appears to be no actual food in this cart. And so I thought, I wonder who that could belong to. And then a very kind of normal woman around my age, you know, with her daughter showed up, claimed the cart. And I thought, if she bought this stuff, I wonder what else she's going to buy. So I'm kind of embarrassed to admit this, but I followed her around the store.
Mm-hmm. And did she give you some looks there?
You know, I think she didn't really notice until we got to the meat department.
Mm-hmm.
And then she said, you know, kind of in general, I mean, I was standing there, so were a couple other people, and she said, gosh, can you believe how expensive chicken breasts are now these days? And she was holding one of those packages of boneless, skinless chicken breasts. I mean, mm-hmm. everyone's seen them. And of course, this gave me an opportunity to talk to her, and I said, hey, you know, whole chickens are on sale for 99 cents a pound, you know, and she just looked at me as if that was the craziest idea that she'd ever heard.
Like, what are you talking about?
She said, I would have no idea what to do with a whole chicken. I mean, she's mortified by the even concept of it. And I said, no, you know, and so somehow or another, I convinced this woman that I wasn't trying to sell her a timeshare in front of the turkey kielbasa, and mm-hmm. that she let me take her over to the butcher. The butcher was really nice. He showed her how to cut up the chicken and then, you know, wrapped it all up and handed it back to her. And she asked a question I thought was really interesting, which she said, how much would that chicken cost if I bought it all, you know, cut up and packaged separately in the case over there? And he calculated it out. And he said, well, you know, I think it'd be around $11. And then she said, but how much is it when I bought it whole? And he said, well, it's on sale for $5.50.
Mm-hmm. And it really,
yes, half the price. And so she gave it back to her, and I was all proud. And then she said, kind of looked at me, and I said, what? She's like, I don't know what to do with the rest of the chicken because I only cook with chicken breast. But thank you anyway, because this was really nice, and I totally understand what you're trying to do. And she started to walk away, and I thought, I can't let this woman get away with her chicken. I don't know what to do with her chicken. I don't know why I was, like, focused on her. So it turned out they were actually selling my first book in this grocery store, the paperback. So I said, wait right here. I went, I got a copy of my book, and I said, I'll buy you this book. I'm not trying to sell this to you, but in it, there's a recipe for mustard braised chicken, and you can use your legs and your thighs, and then there's a recipe for stock, and, you know, so you can use your whole chicken. And somehow or another, I don't know why, but I think I would have just thought it was a crazy person, but she was like, oh, well, that sounds kind of good, but I don't have, like, you know, an onion and carrot and celery in my cart, which, of course, I knew that. And so I said, let's go get it. So we went to the produce department. We got it. And she got all this stuff for this recipe. I mean, it's a very simple and inexpensive recipe, but as we did that, we started to talk about why she made the choices she did and the kinds of stuff she routinely bought, which was primarily convenience foods. And over the course of an hour, she and I went through, I jotted down recipes for some of the things that she had in her cart, like the pasta with Parmesan cheese and things like that, or Alfredo sauce and a variety of other things, including like beef, like, you know, pot roast and stuff. And we actually took most of the boxes out of her cart and replaced it with real food.
And you don't know, though, whatever happened to the woman that started this all.
No, I thought it would be creepy, actually, if I asked her for her home number or something. Like, and by the way, can I have your number and where you live and your, you know, whatever. So I don't know what happened to her, and I hope she knows what she prompted.
Yeah. Well, why did she tell you? Why was it that her cart was filled with convenience foods and no real food?
Well, for one thing, she had the perception that, A, she couldn't cook. I mean, she just felt like she didn't really know how to, say, make a lot of the things were in boxes. She didn't know where to start. And they always turned out, you know, that they were sort of a one-stop solution for, you know, making a dinner. In other cases, it was this concept of time poverty that Americans have. It's very persistent in our culture, which was the, I don't really have time to cook. Conceptual idea, which, you know, when we really started talking about it, it didn't seem like she really actually lacked time. She just didn't see that cooking was as valuable to her in terms of time as doing other things, which included watching television. So I think those were some key things. I think the other factor was, I think she, like a lot of people, really had this idea that, you know, you really have to stock up on a lot of food. You need to have a lot of food around all the time. And I think it's a very kind of American notion as well. I mean, she was spending, admittedly, even when she was buying things, sometimes she was buying stuff like sort of bulk sizes, even of these convenience foods, and admitted that she threw some of them away and that her daughter didn't actually like some of the stuff that they were buying, or that they sometimes ate too much of it, you know, because one box of, say, you know, pasta Alfredo really didn't feel like a meal, but two is too many servings, but they would eat them anyway. So I think it was this really interesting and complex sort of set of answers that, as I've found out in my research, is very consistent with what a lot of people think.
Yeah, and you mentioned that you think there is a big disconnect in this country where we have people who don't think they know how to cook, aren't doing their own home cooking, yet they're watching the Food Network and they're watching celebrity chefs make food. And one woman admitted that she was watching the Food Network while eating tuna helper.
Yes, exactly. She'd watch Gordon Ramsay. She admitted that she had watched Gordon Ramsay while she was eating tuna helper. And I think that it's true. I mean, I think there is sort of a sense of, you know, cooking has become more of a spectator sport, in part because the food environment is very complex, and you don't have to, you know, you could go your whole life without cooking. I mean, it's been very well established that, you know, you can go all day from your toaster pastry to your fast food to, you know, ordering a hamburger at night or microwaving a meal, and you don't have to necessarily know how to cook. But the problem with that scenario is that if you can't cook or you don't cook, that you end up being at the mercy of mostly companies to feed you. And their interest is not necessarily your health. It's in making food as cheap as possible so that they have a higher profit margin.
Yeah. And so you, how did you recruit nine culinary novices to attend your kitchen counter cooking school?
Yeah, so now that I think about it, I'm stunned that anyone did it at all. But I had this idea after meeting this woman and doing some initial research, and I found there wasn't a ton of research done on home cooking and around these particular questions. So I was watching What Not to Wear, and I thought, oh, I could do something like that.
That's a cable TV show?
Yeah, it's a cable television show in which the hosts go through and they have women go through and show them their closets, and then they talk about the choices that they make and what they wear, and they have them show us a typical outfit that you would wear to, say, go to the store or go to work and things like that.
But you just went through their kitchen cupboards.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So I went through their kitchen cupboards, their freezers, their pantries, and then, you know, in the case of the show, they give them a $5,000 visa and tell them to go shop. And I obviously couldn't do that. I'm a writer. But instead, I offered them 10 weeks of cooking lessons and then followed up for, in some cases, up to a year later to see what stuck. And in order to find those people, you know, it was kind of challenging because I wanted to find people from different demographics at different stages in their life. And so a couple of people were recruited through people I knew, and then I went on a local radio show here in Seattle that was hosted by two celebrity chefs, and I kind of put this call out for people to take part. And I thought, oh, you know, I'll probably get home and I'll have four or five emails. And instead, I had dozens of emails. It was really interesting to see that it seemed like it was tapping something sort of deep. You know, there was a lot of regret and guilt and frustration around home cooking, and so I ended up being able to select people who I felt, you know, were able to represent a fairly broad spectrum in terms of ages and what their socioeconomic standing was, and, you know, and their kind of social or situation in terms of whether they were single or married or cohabitating and that sort of thing.
Yeah, and are they making home-cooked meals to this day, as far as you know?
Yeah, everybody had some level of shift in terms of the way they perceived cooking or home cooking. I think the biggest thing is I think they felt more confidence, and I think confidence really seems to be a missing ingredient. I mean, I think people don't cook as often, and I'm not talking, I mean, there are obviously avid home cooks who are going, but I love to cook, and I, you know, I read all my, you know, I make food all the time, and that's definitely true. I'm talking about like a subset of people who didn't really learn to cook. They never took home ec. Maybe their mother didn't cook. They definitely didn't have sort of that established sort of handing down of knowledge that we used to have. It's just sort of part of our part of this cycle of growing up. And I think that's for a whole vast number of, you know, dynamics that have existed in our culture for the past couple of generations. But that's why a lot of researchers believe that in terms of being able to, you know, make decisions around, you know, shopping and being able to just, you know, pick out something random and be able to cook it, we're just about two generations from being able to do that.
Wow. And why is it? Why was it so important to you to help this subset or help counter this trend?
I think that for me, I think I've gotten so much out of home cooking over the course of my life. And I think that, you know, the more I really researched it too, is that, you know, we talk a lot about big issues such as obesity and heart disease and diabetes in this country, but there's a pretty, like, home cooking is a pretty straightforward way to start to answer a lot of those problems. I mean, I think, you know, there's plenty of research that backs up that the more that you cook, you know, the less you weigh, as a general rule, unless you're frying everything, looking at a Paula Deen or, you know, cookbooks or something. But because you tend to be more thoughtful about the food you make and the food you consume. And, you know, people who cook regularly tend to make better choices overall. And when I say cook, I mean cook from whole ingredients, not cook things from a box. I think the second thing about that is that the more I kind of poked around, like learning more about processed foods, I mean, Yeah, I think about it, and you think, would you feed your kid army rations? But in a lot of cases, that's what boxes are. And so I think we kind of don't necessarily realize that. You know, there's a reason why there's powdered mayonnaise, and it didn't start with trying to make it more convenient for home cooks. I mean, it started because they were trying to feed people out on the line somewhere. Mm-hmm. And as a part of this research, I actually talked to a friend of mine who studied chemistry. And at one point, I really think he very genuinely wanted to come up with a cure for cancer. I mean, you know, he really was very ambitious that way, and he ended up going to work for a multinational food company instead and became a food scientist. And one thing he told me was that he doesn't eat any processed food. And when I say processed food, I mean the hyper-processed foods, like, you know, where there's, you know, all these ingredients you can't pronounce, and we all know what those kinds of foods are. Mm-hmm. But he didn't eat them. He didn't have his kids eat them. And one reason he didn't was because he said, well, I kind of know how food additives are approved. They're approved one at a time. But nobody really knows how they interact. Like, nobody really knows how you have a box filled with, like, 20 or 30 ingredients that are all kinds of different chemical, you know, subsets and, you know, partially hydrogenated this and whatever. He said, you know, nobody knows how those react once you actually eat them because they're hard to test on mice. I mean, it can test them, certainly. But he said, when it comes to all that and, like, in everything else that you eat over the course of the day, he's like, we are the mice. Like, we really don't know, like, how all this processed food affects us, except that all we can do is look at, you know, the correlation about when fast food and lots of other kinds of, you know, foods hit the market and so on, and look at that correlation in terms of the other ills that have sort of hit our society. I mean, it's a very complex, you know, equation, obviously, but certainly kind of taking a step back and really thinking about what you're eating and the choices that you're making is a great first step. And I think in some cases that was really a primary result out of the project, as much as, you know, making a lot of food. And I think it's a really important thing to realize too, that I'm not saying you have to make every single meal from scratch, and, you know, not everything has to be local and sustainable and so on. I mean, I think it's really finding a healthier place that you feel comfortable with that's somewhere between Tuna Helper and Top Chef. Yeah.
We are talking with Kathleen Flynn. She is author of The Kitchen Counter Cooking School. And we're talking with her about this trend in a decline of home cooking and a rise in convenience foods and how she's trying to change that. And we're welcoming your questions and your thoughts. Is she talking about you, or are you a culinary novice? Do you think you don't have time to make a lot of your own home-cooked meals from real food, or do you think you lack the knowledge? Why do you think this is, and what questions do you have? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you along. Hope you stay tuned. Coming up tomorrow at this time, it's Kevin McKinley on Your Money. We'll have advice and information on your money with Kevin. And it's also day one of our Half the Time Pledge Drive. And Kevin has a very special thank you gift for everyone who pledges during On Your Money. It's a mini money book on mortgages, everything you need to know about mortgages and refinancing and the like. That's a thank you gift for a pledge tomorrow during On Your Money as we start our fall pledge drive. And remember, this is a very important pledge drive for Wisconsin Public Radio. Need to raise listener support in order to pay for the programming that you value, and we're trying to do it in half the time. Normally, we spend 12 days on the air during a pledge drive. This one will only be 6, but we still need to raise the same amount of money. So you can give us a head start and pledge online ahead of time, WPR.org, and thank you very much. We are talking with the author of The Kitchen Counter Cooking School, How a Few Simple Lessons Transformed 9 Culinary Novices into Fearless Home Cooks. Kathleen Flynn is our guest, and we have many callers, Kathleen, so let me go to the phones and take Laura in Appleton first. Hello, Laura.
Hi. This is a great topic, and you are describing my life perfectly.
Oh, how so?
Well, I find, you know, up until about 5 years ago, I was single, and I did more cooking, not as much as I wanted to because my job got in the way of that a lot of times, but I find that I am married to someone who actually prefers a lot of processed food over many of the things that I would make or would like to make. It's just, you know, it's not part of his experience to have many of the things that I would prefer to eat. And so, for example, a couple weeks ago I made something, I don't remember if it was like a roasted chicken with roasted vegetables or something. Well, he actually wanted me to heat up the microwavable frozen mashed potatoes as opposed to eating, you know, the fresh new potatoes that I had roasted with dinner. So that's one part of my issue. The other is, you know, ever since having a child a few years ago, it truly is much, much more challenging to find the time to cook fresh. I do maybe, you know, I don't know, maybe twice a week a fully home-cooked meal. But it's very hard because my husband is not home at the same time as I am in the evening to help watch her. So, you know, I find that in the rush to get her fed, because she doesn't understand she's hungry, but she is, and she needs to eat now or she'll have a meltdown. Between all of that and the whole evening routine, it's very hard to find a decent chunk of time to do some cooking. So if you have any suggestions on how to deal with a child and a picky eater who actually likes processed food, that'd be great.
Laura, and before you go, did you happen to toss one of your roasted tomatoes at your husband when he said he wanted the frozen ones instead?
No. I'm sure I rolled my eyes and sighed in exasperation.
Well, what kind of advice might you have for Laura, Kathleen?
Yeah, hi, Laura. You know, it's interesting. I have those scenarios in the book as well. That's really interesting. You have really a common situation in both of those situations that you're describing. I mean, one thing you're talking about with your husband, which is, it's, you know, taste preference. And, you know, our tastes are very, you know, taste is something that we kind of get nurtured into, that we like it, the stuff we have when we're a kid, right? So if you eat a lot of processed foods when you're a kid, you know, that can be very persistent into your adulthood. One of the women in my project, actually, she, when we first interviewed her, she said, well, McDonald's tastes like love to me.
Oh.
Because when I was a kid, my parents were divorced. So whoever took me to McDonald's the most, that's who loved me the most. And after she started cooking a lot more and started really paying attention to what she was eating and eating more healthy, she actually found that she didn't really have that. I mean, she still had sort of an emotional connection to it, but she wasn't eating it as often because she found out she didn't feel that great afterwards. But I think one thing, an interesting way to combat that kind of thing is to actually do, and we did this in the book as well and in the project, is to do comparative tasting. So so sometimes people will say, well, I prefer the box version of, say, Alfredo pasta, you know, sauce. But then when you actually make fresh pasta sauce and you serve it directly, competitively against, say, a box version, it often is so significant in the different flavor profiles that it's one way that you might be able to kind of address that and kind of challenge that. I know my husband had that issue when we first married because his mom made almost everything from a box, and I only recently really found out why that was, and it was actually after I finished writing the book, but it's because his mom was shopped a lot at the PX. His parents were in the military, and they had a lot of box foods. And so it's something that, he has also sort of kind of unlearned a lot of those preferences. But having said that, I mean, there is the occasional thing like macaroni and cheese or something that if you have it once in a great while, it's not going to, you know, not going to kill anybody.
Yeah.
I mean, he's going to tell you to pack your knives and go home. But I think the kid thing is really interesting, and I think it is hard. I mean, I really recognize, I don't have children, but I have obviously had people in this project, and I have friends and so on. And one woman actually kind of addressed it by she would make more food on the weekends, and then she would actually, when her husband was home and able to help her watch her kids, or she even had friends come over and would cook with her and even bring their kids. So they were able to make food for their week. And then that way, during the week, they were able to heat it up. So it was something that it was sort of, you know, as one of the women said, she's like, it's like convenience food, except you make it.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, those are both a couple of strategies that, you know, you might want to try out at home. But I totally hear what you're saying, and you're not, you know, you are not alone in either of those issues.
Laura, thank you very much for the call. Then there are those of us, too, Kathleen, who I took home ec in junior high school. My mom cooked, not very well, but she cooked. I try to cook here and there, but I'm just plain not very good at it. So do I need to take a? I am practicing. I'm getting better, but I should take a class, right? Or what should I do?
Yeah, you know, actually, you know, information can never make anything worse.
Mm-hmm.
I think so. You can definitely take a class, or you know, you can take a local cooking class. But you know, I also have partnered with an online cooking school, and they're called Ruxbe.com, and it's Ruxbe.com. But if you just go to my site, which is KathleenFlynn.com, you can go and see it. And essentially what I did was I wanted to develop like this whole, I had this ambitious plan that I was going to put together all these videos so all the readers, you know, could follow along. And then I got into it and thought, wow, video's really hard. I'm not really all that great at it. And so we found this online cooking school, which is awesome. They're really great. And I partnered with them, and I curated a set of lessons that correlate to the book. So you can go through and actually take the lessons sort of along with the volunteers in the class. And there's actually one lesson that everyone can take that I think is really critical and makes a huge difference. It was by far the number one most impactful lesson that any of the volunteers learned in this project. It was unanimous. And that was how to really use a knife and how to use a chef's knife. Because I think when you have some confidence with chopping and cutting, it really makes recipes look a little less daunting. And it goes a lot more quickly. I think you feel more confident. I think, you know, it's also one of the fundamental skills that you really need. I mean, there aren't that many things that make a big difference in terms of being confident, spending less time in the kitchen, and just feeling like you're a more efficient and confident cook is learning how to do knife skills. And you can watch that one for free. So that's free for everybody who wants to go and take a look at it.
I will take a look at it. And we will go next to Lori in Winona, Minnesota. Hello, Lori.
Hi. I think I'm a first-time caller.
Well, I'm glad you called, Lori. Are you someone who does a lot of home cooking with real food?
I do. That's the reason why I called was that I have a lot of hats, but I'm an herbalist and a natural health enthusiast and a nurse practitioner, and I do a lot of teaching and cooking and growing stuff. And the joke that people kind of started because of the advice I give was somebody calls me up and they think, well, what should I take for my cold or my sniffles or my whatever? And I say, well, you got a pot? I go, yeah. Well, you got an onion? Yeah. You got some water? Yeah. Put the onion in the pot with the water. Boil the onion. Drink the soup. They call me in the morning. So I just heard your person saying that they feel people are divorced from cooking and self-care and nurturing and health and all that stuff. And I really see it every day with people that they want to go somewhere and get a commercial product for their sniffles or their allergies or their whatever. And they don't think that there's a lot of really simple, cheap, effective things to do that are also tasty that they can start with. When I teach herb students, the first 3 months of a 9-month class is soup and tea. And, you know, they always want to jump ahead to all the, like, whatever they think esoteric, you know, techie, interesting, cool plant things. Mm-hmm. But so they really are chafing at the bit until they get the concept and the taste and how wonderful it is to take care of yourself by how you cook.
Thank you very much, Lori. Do you have a comment, Kathleen?
Yeah, I think she's absolutely right. And I think that, you know, food can either be a problem or part of the problem, or it can be part of the solution. I mean, you know, you kind of look at, we kind of started the hour talking about, you know, obesity and, you know, health, other health issues such as diabetes and so on. And, you know, a lot of those are diet related. I mean, we don't really like to really talk about it that much. I mean, people hate to hear the word diet, frankly. I mean, but it's not really if you don't think about it in terms of your diet, but just in terms of sort of what you graze on to nourish yourself. I mean, I think, you know, we kind of have turned food into, you know, the set of super experiences all the time. And I think some of that does come from things like the Food Network. And or other cooking shows. I mean, I don't want to just single them out because they're, you know, cooking shows on I think 22 different channels now, so it's not just them. But I think that, you know, there's kind of this idea that, you know, people eat out a lot. They eat out significantly more than they used to. You know, people are expected to eat meat at almost every meal. That didn't used to be the case. I mean, there's a lot of research that shows that if you cut back on your dairy and meat consumption, then, you know, that can have a very direct relational hit on your health in terms of making you more healthy. I think, you know, just even going out to eat has really changed people's perceptions in terms of, you know, portions. I mean, I think we have no concept of portions in the U.S. I used to live abroad. I lived in, you know, both the United Kingdom and France, and one of the things that really struck me when I first moved back, and I had kind of culture shock of repatriation back to the United States after living abroad for 7 years, was how big portions were. I mean, you know, a portion of steak is not 12 ounces. A portion of, you know, meat or beef or any protein is 4 ounces. So I think it's sort of this, you know, we've kind of supersized ourselves, and some of it has come from, you know, different kinds of things like fast food and just going out to eat. But I think then we've also sort of super experienced ourselves into a much higher expectation of what is dinner. I mean, when I talk to chefs about what they actually eat at home, I've interviewed a lot of chefs, and they make things like a pot of beans, or they'll have bread and jam, or they'll have leftover soup. I mean, chefs don't cook the way they do in their restaurants. But I think that we've been sort of told that home cooks, if you're an aspirational home cook, you want to cook like the people on Top Chef. And I think that seems so intimidating that I think is one of the obstacles and the barriers to why people don't cook at home more.
Good point.
But yeah, as she was saying, I mean, food is really ultimately meant to nourish you.
Another question from Jen on Facebook. Do you have any tips on home cooking on a budget? A lot of people, you do bring up this point that you should do more home cooking with real food if you're on a budget.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is interesting. I think that there is sort of this this sort of belief, and it's sort of true and also sort of misguided, that, you know, if you want to cook with whole ingredients, that it's more expensive. And there's some truth to that, in the respect that as a country, we subsidize things like corn and wheat and so on, but we don't subsidize broccoli, you know, mm-hmm. really in any kind of, you know, significant way. So sometimes it does seem like fresh produce is more expensive. But one thing that a lot of my project members found is that they went and they found alternates to buying some products in the supermarket. So, for instance, they found farm stands that were a lot cheaper, or they found ethnic places that were more inexpensive in terms of buying vegetables. And, you know, I'm going to also throw out there, I mean, you know, there's, as a general rule, really nothing particularly wrong with frozen vegetables, which are often less expensive than fresh, and sometimes they actually have more nutrients because they haven't traveled, you know, from another country in order to get to your supermarket, you know, where they may have already been picked for like over a week and week and a half and so on. In the book, I do have a bunch of suggestions around that. And I also, you know, throw out a challenge. It's like, if you think that buying something with a box is a lot less expensive, you know, turn that box over and see what you have to add to it. I mean, in cases of, say, pasta or, you know, some kind of meal mixes and stuff like that, I mean, you actually add up, say, you know, you're going to make
something with hamburger, I mean, you still have to add the hamburger to the box, which is $2.50 or whatever. And the hamburger is the most expensive part. And really, then you have to ask yourself, what's in the box? Like, what are you trying to replicate? Is it, you know, sautéing an onion and a green pepper and maybe, you know, a bit of spice and a jar of tomato, a can of tomatoes? I mean, if you start adding that up, that's frequently less or equivalent in terms of the cost of what's in the box. But it's much more healthy, and you're not getting a lot of other stuff that, you know, you can't pronounce.
We are talking with Kathleen Flynn. She is author of The Kitchen Counter Cooking School. We are talking about how so many people are overwhelmed by the idea of cooking, or think they don't have enough time, or they buy too many convenience foods because they don't feel they are very adept in the kitchen. And we're talking about how to change that, and we're welcoming your questions. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Do you cook, or do you depend a lot on eating out or takeout or convenience foods? And what's stopping you from cooking more? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Hoping you'll stay tuned. Coming up after 9 o'clock, Kathleen Dunn is with you, talking about all things political. That's coming up. Right now, we are talking about home cooking and why so many of us, or many of us anyway, don't do our own home cooking with whole foods, with real food. Our guest is Kathleen Flynn. She is the author of The Kitchen Counter Cooking School, How a Few Simple Lessons Transformed 9 Culinary Novices into Fearless Home Cooks. And she will be in Wisconsin on November the 9th at 7 p.m. at the Next Chapter Bookstore in the Milwaukee area. And our next caller for her is Jeff in Antioch, Illinois. Hello, Jeff.
Hi, Joy. How are you?
I'm good. How are you? Are you a cook?
I am a cook. Mm-hmm. I've been a cook, I'm 57 years old, and when I was a junior in high school, a friend of mine and I were the first two boys to ever sign up for home ec.
Well, good for you. And did you do that because you wanted to learn to cook, or you wanted to meet some girls?
Well, yes.
Okay, both.
But Mrs. Quick, she's probably the...
Oh, no. We're losing you, Jeff. Say it again.
Oh, I'm sorry. Mrs. Quick was probably the fondest teacher I had in high school. And she taught us, the most important thing she taught me was to don't be afraid and experiment. Give it a try. If you think it sounds good, try it. The worst case scenario, you'll be ordering a pizza tonight, but you might have a recipe that you'll enjoy the rest of your life.
Yeah, don't be afraid to experiment, Kathleen.
Absolutely. And I think that it's, you know, a really important point that he brings up, which is, you know, I think, you know, when you're not confident, you have a tendency to look at a recipe and think, I can't make a single variation on this recipe. I mean, oh, my goodness, I don't have time. This is, you know, the time, like, or oregano or something. I don't have one particular thing, and this will never work out. And I think that, you know, a really great thing to do is to kind of go off the trail sometimes with the recipe and just make substitutions, and it makes you a better cook. And it's, you know, most of the time it turns out, you know, I mean, it's fine, you know, and you're going to make another meal, you know, 3 hours later. I mean, it's okay. And, you know, I think it kind of goes to something else too, which is that a lot of people buy things specifically for recipes. And, you know, while they have other ingredients in their fridge that they let go to waste. And when people talk about their food bills a lot, they'll say, oh, you know, food is so expensive. But really, as a country in the United States, and it's true in Canada also, I'm sure you probably have some listeners in Canada, that Americans and Canadians both spend the least amount of money in terms of a percentage of their overall income than any other country in the world. It's around 10%. By comparison, if you live in Ethiopia, you spend 70% of your income that you make on food.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's significantly decreased since 1960. We, you know, it's gone down from about 35% of our income down to 10%. And a lot of that's around commercialization and you know, and other things. And, you know, agribusiness gets a bad rap a lot of the time, but they have made food less expensive, and that's, you know, the truth. And whether or not you agree with how they've done it is a whole other show. But But I think, you know, maybe the reason that people waste so much food is because it's not as expensive. So I really, this is an interesting point that I didn't even go into this project thinking about at all. But we waste about 30% of the food that we bring home.
Yeah, guilty. I'll do that too. You know, where you buy some lettuce
common.
And you know, it just gets bad in the and that's in part because I might say, I'll use that tomorrow, and then you know, some other excuse.
Yeah, and I think that what happens is that we kind of hear, you know, we get the message, oh, you're supposed to eat fruits and vegetables. Like, I think people get that message, but then so they shop for, you know, kind of their aspirational life, like, I will aspire to make, you know, vegetables every day this week. And then, you know, something else comes up, you know, they order pizza, they go out to eat, they make other choices that doesn't involve, you know, that doesn't involve your food that's in your crisper, and then you throw it away. And so I think if you can recover that money back into your grocery bill, you know, it makes significant difference to people in terms of how much money they're spending on their food. And, you know, maybe you can buy higher quality food or whatever you want to do with that extra money. And I have two tips for listeners on that. And one is, the next time you go shopping, or even right now, you can go to your fridge, get a set of Post-it notes, and estimate how much everything in your fridge costs. Like, you know, from that $3 you spent on broccoli to the $4 you spent on, you know, the organic mesclun or whatever. And, you know, put labels on all your food. And as you go to throw something away, keep that Post-it note and start putting them all in one place together and do it for a couple of weeks. It's pretty surprising how much they add up to. Because most people would not throw away a $5 bill. Mm-hmm. But they'll throw away $5 worth of food with kind of a shrug.
Yeah. So how do we should also then plan what we're going to eat and not buy tons of stuff that we don't know what we're going to do with.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, it's really a pretty straightforward way to solve that. Is one is, I think meal planning is really a skill that we've collectively lost. I mean, even in this group of people who I talked to, only one person had ever planned a meal, and. And now I think that's one thing that really shifted for a lot of people. They go and they have sort of a plan. They, you know, they have a list. They have an idea of the actual meals they're going to make, and they, you know, may change based on what's on sale once they get to the store. But they shop more often. And people say, I don't have time to shop. But if you think about what your time is worth, I mean, if you're throwing out 20 or 30 bucks worth of groceries every week because you're not having a plan and you're trying to stock up on things that ultimately are very perishable, you know, you might start thinking, maybe it's worth like an extra half an hour for you to go to the store.
Right.
One more trip during the week, you know, just so that I'm, you know, trying to, you know, shop with sort of the very immediate future in mind. The other thing that I notice, and I've been to a lot of people's houses now, not just the people who are in the book. I mean, it's kind of a, you know, thing I keep doing. Apparently I'm the nosiest person in the world. But most people's fridges are really full. I mean, you know, they're like so full people can barely shut the door, and yet they'll open it up and go, there's nothing eaten here. And as one guest chef guest teacher came into my project said, it's like, what are you expecting, like a hand to reach out and go, here's a sandwich?
Right,
like
right.
This. But is to take a picture of something you really love, like, you know, your favorite thing to look at, whether it's your kid or your dog or your family or whatever, and put it in the back of your refrigerator. And your fridge shouldn't be so full that you can't see that picture. And if it is, then eat down your fridge and go through and start pulling things out of your fridge and start figuring out what to do with them. I mean, one great thing about the internet is you can take your broccoli out, you can take some cheese out, you can do whatever, plug them into a search engine, you know, in terms of a recipe search engine that you find reliable, and then, you know, have a whole bunch of different options of what you can do with it. And if you don't have all those ingredients, that's fine. Like, just try it. Give it a try.
Good idea. You know? Let me take some more calls. Ann in Highland is with us next. Hello, Ann.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I used to be pretty much a convenience food bum until I discovered I had a soybean allergy 2 years ago, which means I can no longer eat any processed foods at all.
Nice.
So I've gone to cooking everything, and the best resource I had to make the conversion was old cookbooks, older the better. because these recipes are not only good and healthy and tasty, they don't include processed foods, because most modern cookbooks include a can of cream of mushroom soup or a box of cake mix or something. But in addition to these good recipes, these older books include all kinds of what my grandma considered common sense information we don't really have a great handle on anymore. You know, definitions and terms of cooking processes, tips on preparing, ingredient conversion charts, you know, all these things that we just don't have as a natural information source anymore. They're in these old cookbooks. And so you can make that jump with these old books very easily because the recipes are great and all this extra information they include is wonderful.
Good idea. What do you think, Kathleen?
Yeah, no, that's, you know, I just almost started laughing out loud when you said that because it's so true, mm-hmm. Right? I mean, it's like you go back to the joy of cooking because, you know, it was started, you know, and I use an old version of the joy of cooking. I think mine is from 1968 or something like that. And it's, you know, they're reliable recipes, and but it also has a lot of other information that, you know, I think the reason why it has reference information is because the people who are cooking from those books knew how to cook, and sometimes they weren't necessarily looking just for the recipe. They were actually looking for what's that ratio, like what's that convert, you know, I mean, they were looking for sort of more fundamental information that I think a lot of modern cookbooks don't include because they're very recipe driven, and I think they're recipe driven because they kind of get that a lot of people don't know how to cook without a recipe. So I think that the way that they were organized and conceived in terms of, you know, general cookbooks is very different.
Yeah. And that's a book that would tell me how to make your mustard braised chicken, because I have to admit I'm not positive what braising means.
No, that's a really good point. I think that the new book, we talked pretty extensively about braising. But there is a great book just called All About Braising by Molly Stevens. It's a terrific, you know, primer on the whole subject and explains exactly what's happening inside the pot.
Yeah, your book does talk about that, too. I meant to say that, but that's part of the issue is that, you know, some of us novices don't know some of these terms, and that stops us.
And a lot of recipe writers leave them out now. Mm-hmm. They won't say braise something. They'll say put it into a pot and put, you know, cover it and then simmer it for 20 minutes, which is really all braising is. But I think it's that we've lost part of the fundamental language of the kitchen because we don't use it. Yeah. It's just like if you took French when you're in high school, but you don't use it for 30 years.
We have a minute to go. Do you have a 30-second pep talk for us on, you know, what you hope is accomplished by your book and by your work?
Yeah, I would say, you know, it's time for people to, you know, really take their kitchens back, you know, one meal at a time. And if you can cook, then find someone around you who is not a confident cook and start helping them learn. And if you're not confident, you know, just do it. I mean, the way you learn how to do anything is just by doing it.
Yeah. And are you able to do any of your own cooking when you're on your book tour?
It's really challenging.
Yeah, it must be.
It's really challenging on a book tour, I'm going to be honest. But we've been trying to, you know, try to eat more whole foods. This is the first time I think I've packed apples.
Good. Well, we look forward to your visit in Wisconsin on November the 9th. Thanks very much for being with us.
Great. Thank you so much, Joy.
Kathleen Flynn, author of The Kitchen Counter Cooking School. Thanks to Amanda Magnus and to Rob Ferret for producing the hour. This is the Ideas Network.